Dr. Hans-Georg Eichler has served as Senior Medical Officer of the European Medicines Agency, advising the EMA Executive Director on all scientific and public health issues since 2006. Dr. Eichler has contributed to research at several renowned institutions in the U.S., the United Kingdom, and South Africa, and is a member of several medical advisory boards at the Austrian Ministry of Health. I am Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Director for DIA Global Forum magazine. I am delighted to be with Dr. Eichler to learn his thoughts about his career, critical issues in drug development and regulatory science in the European Union and globally. Welcome, Dr. Eichler, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Alberto.
My first question is around breakthrough therapy designations and accelerated approval procedures, which have been both applauded and criticized. Applauded for getting therapies to market more quickly, and criticized for their potential to sacrifice regulatory science for regulatory speed. What is your perspective on these issues?
So thank you for a question that is very close to our heart because we're confronted with this almost on a daily basis. So around the globe, we have a number of so-called facilitated pathways, as you say, all of which aim to allow timely access for those patients who need them early. And yes, there is a chorus of voices that says this is wrong. No rush. We want to see thoroughly tried and tested therapies. We are against all these facilitated pathways. There is, in the vast majority of cases, no need really to speed anything. Well, I disagree with that. There are patients in need today. There are not just some patients in the distant future somewhere, but we hear it loud and clear from a growing chorus of patient representatives who say, we have a window of opportunity now, and that window of opportunity will shut soon. The best drug, the safest drug that you bring to market is no good for me if it comes after the day of my funeral. And that is a logic you cannot argue with. So we consider timely access to be a value in itself. And the art and science is to allow that timely access without sacrificing scientific rigor. So if someone says we're lowering the standards, we're cutting corners, we're sacrificing science, I wholeheartedly disagree. What we need to see is how we can optimize the terms of the trade-offs between timely access and full and thorough information about a product. So it's this access versus evidence trade-off. So how can you optimize the terms of the trade-off? Well, first, I think you have to be smart. You have to recognize that not all patients are in the same situation. Not all patients have the same urgency of treatment. So can you direct your development program towards those patients who have the highest need and where your product has the best chances of moving the needle for those patients? That would be number one. So you can have a faster development program to goal if you focus first on a smaller population rather than going from big to small as we did in the days of the blockbusters. Being smart is one thing, but being honest is the other thing. So we have to recognize that even if we do a stellar job in development, even if we speed up our assessments, etc., there will always be additional information needs. We cannot know everything. We have never done so in the past. But maybe sometimes we have pretended that on the day of licensing, we know everything about a product, which was never true. And history has shown us that this is never true. So we want to be honest, and we say we take a lifespan approach to learning and evidence generation. The day of initial licensing is not the end of learning. We continue to research the product, not haphazardly, but we have a plan in place for post-licensing evidence generation. And we negotiate that with the companies. In Europe, we're fortunate in the sense that we can also now negotiate that with downstream decision makers, notably HTA bodies and payers, and say, so what are the next steps if we allow the product on the market for those who need it now? What then? What are the trials we'll do? What is the real-world evidence we will look at? How can we manage the utilization? How can we then, in a planned and rational way, increase utilization, i.e., enlarge the treatment-eligible population? That, to me, will be the success factors for the facilitated pathways.
For many years, you have been a very public advocate of dialogue with sponsors and HTAs and regulators in the same room or in the same virtual room, at least. If accelerated pathways result in, shall we say, a lesser amount of clinical data being available prior to licensing, what implications might that have for HTAs and payers to decide on the value of a medicine if they push back and they say, well, there isn't enough data here from the clinic to help us in the reimbursement community make a decision on reimbursement? Have you seen that sort of dilemma or difficulty arise?
The answer is yes. But before I come to your question, can I allow me, please, to probe one of your statements. You say less valid data. Well, that's exactly what we don't want. Maybe more focused data for a narrow, well-described patient group, but it shouldn't be of a lower standard, of a lower quality. Now, having said that, you're absolutely right, and the best way to describe the problem you posed was my colleague Sean Tunis from the US, who said, we will achieve nothing if we build a highway through regulatory space, and then you hit a gravel road as you go through payer space. And I couldn't agree more.
An effective image.
A very good image, yes. And so we have to avoid the gravel road. Is it there? Yes, absolutely. And I'm now speaking for a European environment where payers tell us exactly what you say. So you want us to pay earlier premium prices for something where we know less about? Why should we? So that is why it is so important that we have those decision makers on board right from the beginning. They have to be part of the team that designs the evidence generation pathway. And it has to be designed in such a way that in the end, if all goes well, not only the regulator can say yes to a certain treatment eligible population, but also the payers. That excludes, of course, the discussion about price. We can only talk about evidence generation. If there is no agreement on price between payers and companies, well, that is a different matter. But what we can try to harmonize, and we're doing that, is the evidence requirements.
Have there been examples, and I'm not asking for names of anybody, but have there been examples of HTAs agreeing with you, the regulators, and the sponsor that a lesser amount of data coming out of the clinic will be potentially sufficient for the HTA to rule positively in favor of a medicine? In the context of an accelerated pathway, that is.
So the answer is absolutely yes. HTA bodies that advise payers in Europe are aware of that conundrum that we are facing, this excess versus evidence conundrum. And they're not blind to it. So they realize that some compromises will have to be made. And we have plenty of experience now of interactions between regulatory assessors and HTA assessors. So outside of the adaptive pathways pilots, which I will touch in a second, we have by now completed nearly 70 cases where we had a company, a developer in the room, the regulators, and a number of EU-based health technology assessment bodies. And in the majority of cases, not in all cases, but in the majority of cases, in the end, we came to a conclusion to design a development pathway that would meet the information needs of both the HTAs and the regulators. So I would say this is, in most of the cases, a success story. When it comes to the accelerated pathways, I will give you the example of the adaptive pathways pilots, where we also have regulators and HTA bodies in the room. And there again, we see that there isn't always perfect agreement, and you wouldn't expect that. But in a large number of cases, we can come to a solution that is satisfactory for all these decision makers. So I'm very optimistic about the evidence requirements.
Thank you. Very clear perspective. Let me move on to another area that is of high interest. That is big data. Big data seems to offer much promise from a statistical and analytical perspective, yet at the same time, it raises data ownership, protection, and privacy concerns. What are your thoughts around these issues?
I see these data, and whether you call it big data or whether you call it real-world data, I will not go into that. Let's park that. So there are a number of issues about validity, data quality, whether you, what evidence you can glean from this essentially non-randomized information. Let's park that as well. That is a topic in itself. What is also hindering this real-world evidence generation is, as you rightly say, the issue of who owns it, have patients been consented? No, they haven't. Who can use them, for what purpose, etc. We have been in discussions with many patients, with many stakeholders in Europe about exactly that topic. And the positive thing that I find very encouraging is from the vast majority of patients, they say, look, we're okay if our data can help someone, some other patients downstream in 5 years. We want our data to be shared, with a caveat. And the caveat, of course, is that my concerns about privacy are addressed. I don't want my data to influence my next job application because someone knows I have a disease. I don't want my data to interfere with my application for health insurance and all that. That is understood. So I would say laudably, and I'm very happy about that, the vast majority of patients say, yes, let's go ahead. With that caveat, there have to be the safeguards in place. I would even go a step further, but that's my personal view. In Europe, we're very proud of the fact that we have solidarity-based healthcare systems. That means if I am diagnosed with, say, cancer tomorrow, society will be here to support me and support my health bills. That's the essence of solidarity-based healthcare. My question is, shouldn't solidarity then go in both directions? Should society not expect from me a basic willingness to share my data so that the next generation of patients can be helped? And I would argue that is a debate we should have in future. The two-way street of solidarity, always bearing in mind that the safeguards for personal data privacy and protection have to be in place. But I would see that as our next frontier of discussions.
This idea of two-way solidarity appears to be supported by what you described as patients saying, yes, I'm willing to share my data as long as safeguards are in place.
Absolutely, yes.
Are those safeguards in place? I mean, can patients be assured of their privacy today, or in the era of hacking, is everybody's data practically at risk?
So is everybody's data practically at risk? I mean, you just need to read the news and you will see that everything is at risk. So I think, again, we have to be honest. We cannot promise any patient that there will be zero risk. But don't forget one thing. We don't have zero risk today. So your data could be hacked today, or my healthcare data. Whether we use them, the data, for any other research purposes, yes or no. So the risk is already there. And there are examples when healthcare data have been put to very good use without risk. So think in Europe, we have a lot of experience in the NSIP collaboration. Think of the United States. I'm a great admirer of the Sentinel initiative that has been put to very good and productive use. Have patients been harmed? Not to my knowledge.
Thank you. Another question. In an interview with the TB Alliance, you explained that regulators have always had two roles to play. One, the gatekeeper role that ensures that drugs which are not safe and effective are not given to patients. And two, the enabler role fosters new beneficial drugs and gets them more quickly to patients. Where are the stress points between these two roles? What are some recent gatekeeper and enabler success stories in the European Union? And what lessons can they teach other global regulators?
So, Alberto, you asked me two questions. One, what is the stress points and what are the success stories? Yes. Let me start with the stress points. In the current debate in Europe, and I'm speaking now a Eurocentric view, sure, we have two stress points. One is at the operational level, and one is, shall we say, at the evidence level. At the operational level, we have just launched the Prime Initiative, and we have asked for public comments. And that has, again, raised a debate that has been simmering for years. And that is, to what extent can and should the regulator be involved in designing development pathways? In our language, we call that the scientific advice. Should a regulator, as we do and as we have done for 10 years, sit down with a company? The company says, I'm planning to do this phase one, phase two, phase three studies. Do you, regulator, agree? Or do you want it differently? And when we go into a debate, what are the endpoints? What are the selection criteria, etc.? And there are voices out there who said that will lead to regulatory capture. That is a conflict of interest for the regulators. If they engage in that dialogue with the companies, they should not do it. We very strongly disagree with that. We think it is an ethical imperative for a regulator to ensure that the studies that are done in order to develop a product will then be up to snuff. This is not talking about results. This is talking about methodologies. And we have a role in telling a company, don't do that study because we will not accept it in the end. Whatever the results are, we think that this is the wrong endpoint. We will not accept this as a basis of a license. And we should at all costs prevent such studies from being done. So yes, that is a stress point, but we make our view very clearly known that we don't think this is about regulatory capture. We don't think this is a conflict of interest. By contrast, this is a moral and ethical imperative to do that. So that's at the operational level. At the evidence level, the stress point right now between the enabler and the gatekeeper is what we have discussed earlier. That is this conundrum between timely access and evidence. And we have said that, yes, inherently there will always be a stress point, but we should seek to optimize the terms of the trade-offs. And that brings us back to the debate that we have just had. So that is, I would say, the other stress point. Now, to your second question, can I name some of the success stories in the EU and what others could learn? So I would name two success stories. One is the SME office. SME in Europe stands for small and medium enterprises. And we realized that in the past, we only interacted with big pharma. They have all the experience, they have the specialists in place, and that's fine. But there are other innovative players out there who may have very promising products that will ultimately help patients, but these companies, small entities, they just don't have the experience, they don't have the firepower to interact with us. To them, we are like an ivory tower that is impenetrable. So we set up that office dedicated to helping those small entities, take them by the hand, not give them a different evidence standard, an easy road to licensing, but to give them the opportunity to know what to do next, how to interact, what is expected of them. And I would say that was a success story in Europe that isn't available in other regions. The second success story that I would like to point out is the adaptive pathways pilots that we are running currently. And it isn't a success story in the sense yet that it can be producing results. It has produced results because we're still learning, we're in the early stages. But I would argue that the regulator's willingness to experiment, to sit down in a safe harbor environment and say, can we do something different? Can we bring companies in and see how we can do a better job? And not just companies, but with patients, with HTA bodies. I think that in itself I would call a success because it signals a willingness to think out of the box, to experiment, because that's what essentially it is. We're experimenting, and we don't know what the outcome is, but we have that willingness to be open. I call that a success story.
In relation to this experimentation on Prime, for example, and other initiatives, how much dialogue and coordination has there been with other regulators across the various oceans? Of course, ICH is now 25 years old, but have there been any degrees of coordination when launching these accelerated pathways with the FDA, with Japan and EMA being involved?
Absolutely.
Have there been dialogues? Have you coordinated in some way?
Absolutely. We have, for example, just had a colleague of mine, a staff member of the EMA, go to FDA to learn from the lessons of the breakthrough pathways. We're keenly aware of what the Japanese colleagues do with the Sakigake. So, of course, we want to learn from the best. We want to incorporate what their positive findings. We want to avoid also their mistakes. And I think this is what we should all do in an open society interactively in future. So we will share our experiences, good and bad, with our colleagues across these oceans.
Thank you very much for speaking with the IEA Global Forum today, Dr. Eichler. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Alberto.